take a 5. Moving on to deferred tax, and it's Gustavo's first meeting, so normal rules apply. We need to be nice to him. All bets are off next time.
Okay, so we now move to agenda paper 5. So at this meeting in March, the committee discussed a question about the recognition of deferred taxes when a lessee recognizes an asset and a liability at lease commencement. The same question arises in relation to the recognition of decommissioning assets and liabilities. At that meeting, the committee decided to research developing an interpretation aimed at addressing the question. In this paper, we present further analysis and explore the possible standard setting options. We start by analyzing the requirements in IS 12 to recognize deferred taxes and the initial recognition exemption. Our analysis demonstrates that when an entity attributes tax deductions to the lease liability, equal and offsetting temporary differences arise at lease commencement. The initial recognition exemption applies to those temporary differences, and an entity does not recognize deferred tax either on initial recognition or subsequently. Paragraphs 39 to 42 of the paper illustrates the outcome of this. For the reasons described in paragraphs 50 to 54, we think the exemption is not necessary in these situations. A possible solution, therefore, would be to narrow the scope of the exemption so that it does not apply to the transaction that give rise to both deductible and taxable temporary differences, to the extent that an entity recognizes deferred tax assets and liabilities of the same amount. Another possible solution we explore is to develop an interpretation of IS 12, as described in paragraph 62 to 66 of the paper. For the reasons described in paragraph 69, we recommend developing a narrow scope amendment to IS 12 that would narrow the application of the initial recognition exemption. We would also recommend that the committee does not propose further application guidance on determining the tax base of assets and liabilities. I will now hand over to the committee for comments and thoughts on the possible way forward on this project.
Okay.
Technically, I totally appreciate the staff analysis. I think we can perfectly understand the outcome of the analysis. I've already expressed that, but I'm worried by if I depart from the strict technical analysis, then on the cost-benefit approach applied to this, and notably to the situation of my application to IFRS 16. We have hundreds of contracts, but companies have thousands of contracts in hundreds of jurisdictions. And if you need to consider an IS 12 full balance sheet approach to all this, IFRS 16 is already something difficult to implement, but then the deferred tax assets and liabilities applied to all those various situations is far more complex. So then I would probably depart from and a bit disagree with the assessment in paragraph 53 that the staff is making, saying, therefore, in our view, the exemption is not necessary for a lease transaction. Technically, I understand. On a mere cost-benefit approach, I would rather depart from this assessment. And maybe if I can be a bit more precise, and the reason why is because IFRS 16, that way, is a convention. IS 17 at another convention. It was merely for operating lease contract of balance sheet commitments. IFRS 16 states it's to be accounted for in the balance sheet. Fine. And then to this convention, and eventually US GAAP has another convention, not strictly aligned to IFRS. And then you apply a perfect full IS 12 model to this initial convention. So it's where I'm a bit annoyed. I do not disagree with the technical analysis. I perfectly understand it. I'm not sure I have any objection to it. But then when I see that on a mere day-to-day application and on a cost-benefit approach, then I'm a bit annoyed by this outcome, actually.
So Bertrand does
and,
that?
And it's also because maybe, sorry, it's also because effectively you mentioned something that is quite crucial in this. It's in paragraph 49, you're saying... I mean, it's obvious, but I prefer to read it and to repeat it. Applying ICE... you say, the submission described a fact pattern in which lease payments are deductible for tax purposes on a cash basis. That is fact. The tax deduction comes from the lease payments. And then you say, applying IAS 12, an entity attributes these tax deductions to the lease asset or lease liability to determine their respective tax basis and initial recognition. There it begins to begin a bit theoretical. Because really, it's not reality. You will do a rather theoretical attribution. It begins to... So you to apply a perfect IAS 12 balance sheet model, you begin to distort reality in attributing, rather theoretically, a tax deduction for the accounting model. And it's what really annoys me, actually, in a mere cost-benefit approach, even though technically I understand the outcome.
Bertrand, I understand your cost-benefit point, but can I just understand what that approach would mean in terms of the financial reporting outcome? So in paragraph 42, there's a... an example of what the effect would be on the effective tax rate.
Sure.
Is that the...
Then what you could do is if you would accept the fact that there is an exemption to the deferred tax computation, then this would be a permanent tax difference in the tax proof, and you could easily, in terms of financial reporting, then impose a disclosure to explain, notably where this permanent tax difference comes from.
I just wanted to understand what the outcome is.
Yeah, this is out of order, sorry, but I have a similar discomfort on the same point. I think it's a permanent tax difference. It's not a temporary tax difference. It makes all the difference. And I also think it's a very abstracted to conclude that the deduction of the lease payments, you must attribute that to the lease liability. I'm not sure. I'm not convinced. Is that correct? Lease payment is one thing. The lease liability is not.
I mean, if it's helpful to explain, obviously, just to let you know, at least that aspect, we don't think we're not just kind of making that up and proposing it here as a starting solution. I suppose our starting point is. That's what IAS 12 tells you to do. Now, there's obviously a discussion to say whether we think there's something so special about this situation that we think it warrants and justifies doing, you know, departing from what IAS 12 says or whatever. But as a starting point, that's just what IAS 12 tells you to do.
That's why I was saying, yeah, sure, I understand the technical conclusion, for sure. But then there is other aspects, and in terms of reporting, yeah, I perfectly appreciate that it's not perfect. The outcome is not necessarily, it's not perfect for sure. But then you could require then additional requirements in terms of disclosure to explain why there is such a huge permanence tax difference in the tax proof, for instance, and notably. We can then figure it out. I'm just annoyed by the layer of complexities that is added for computing taxes on thousands of operating lease contracts that arise from hundreds of different tax jurisdictions. And you need to assess that on a taxpayer basis first. Then if you have a tax group relief on the at the level of the tax group relief, so it's double analysis you need to perform in, yeah.
Okay. Carl, did you have more you wanted to add?
It's another topic.
Thanks.
In terms of the proposed solution, I do not object. I think it's fine in terms of a pragmatical approach. However, it's not clear to me the conceptual basis. I'm trying to figure out what the balance sheet would like in day one of after the amendment is performed. It's not clear to me if it was gross or not, if you have gross or not values. And I think that the offset feature is important in the analysis, but before offset, I'm not comfortable what the debit credits would look like regarding the deferred tax. I have a big discomfort in that piece.
Well, if we narrowed the initial recognition exception so it didn't apply in this case, what you would get is you would get a temporary difference on initial recognition. You get two temporary differences, and you get a deferred tax asset and a deferred tax liability. And we're saying that, you know, if those two amounts are the same, you don't need the temporary, you don't need the initial recognition exception, because you can debit one and credit the other, and there's no impact on profit or loss, which is really what the initial recognition exception was trying to avoid. So you just have these deferred tax assets and deferred tax liabilities as they would normally arise out of IS 12, and then going forward they would unwind as they would normally under IS 12. Did that answer your question?
No.
Okay, sorry.
No. Were you asking about the presentation as well?
Yes. It's not clear to me the debit and credits of the deferred tax after the amendment.
Are you asking about on the balance sheet versus in the P&L? Because Anne's comments were addressing offset within tax expense. I think Carl was asking about...
Before the offset.
You were talking about more the balance sheet, whether it's gross or whether you're having a net item for at least...
No, it's clear it will be net. But I think one step before the offset... We need to do the proper debits and credits. Yeah. It's not clear to me.
So let's say, and I'm just making up numbers here, Carl, but let's say I initially recognise a lease asset of 100, a lease liability of 100. What I'd have behind the scenes, in a sense, is a deferred tax, assuming I attribute the deduction to the liability of temporary differences, then I'd have a deferred tax asset, say, of 30, relating to the lease liability, and I'd also have a deferred tax liability of 30, relating to the lease asset, and potentially for presentation purposes, the deferred tax asset and deferred tax liability of 30.
Is the credit and debit side of the deferred tax?
On day one, when you debit the deferred tax asset, what's your credit?
Yeah.
That's what he's asking.
Okay.
It's in the P&L. It's the default position in IS 12.
So
they would both go through the P&L as the default position in IS 12 and offset each other.
Yes.
We're offsetting the P&L.
Yeah.
Well, they're both there.
Yeah.
You wouldn't see them in the P&L, but in theory...
But that's where the credits and the debits are going.
Yes.
There's a debit asset, credit P&L, debit credit liability, debit P&L.
Mm-hmm.
Bob.
I'm in agreement with the direction of the staff recommendation. I like this direction much better than we had at the last meeting. And last meeting, I did try to argue for there's no temporary difference. Lost that, then we went this direction.
That's where you're seated next to Bertrand.
I did not like the direction we were going, where you had to try to figure out whether the tax reduction related to the asset or a liability. I just didn't think that was practical to do. So I can agree with this. I just had two questions for the staff on this. If I'm looking at paragraph 72, it says the amendment would propose that the initial recognition exemption does not apply to the extent that the tax asset and tax liability are of the same amount. Do you really mean if they're different, then would you get to apply the initial recognition exemption? I didn't think that was meant.
We're trying to avoid using the initial recognition exception where you don't need to, and we think you don't need to if the result is that you would have no net effect in profit or loss, because the arguments for the initial recognition exception is it doesn't make sense to have a gain or loss on an equal exchange. So we don't want something hitting P&L through the tax. But if what is ending up in profit or loss is zero, then we don't need this initial recognition exception. And whenever we have exceptions in standards, they create complications. They create complications afterwards for knowing whether sort of movements in the tax space are the bit that was recognized or the bit that wasn't recognized. So the more we can do without an exception, the better. And here, not having an exception solves the problem that's there in practice and improves the standard. So, it's brilliant. Win-win, I would say.
I didn't disagree with anything you said, but in the case where yes. the asset is different than the liability, can I then argue that, yeah, I get to apply the exemption? Mm.
Yes, that is what we're saying.
That we would must
indeed
apply the exemption.
Yes.
No, I'm jumping out. So, is that just to the difference or to the entire balance? That wasn't clear to me.
Yeah.
I think we were thinking that it would be to the difference.
Yeah, right.
But if you think that we've not thought through, practical problems then about how you allocate future changes, I mean, I can see that there could be difficulty, but I don't think they'd be worse than the sort of difficulties we have already.
I understand. Just because I was thinking I would not apply it to the gross amounts.
No, we would say that to the extent that you only apply it to get rid of an effect in profit or loss.
Okay.
So if there's a difference, you apply it, and I'm not quite sure exactly how we'll word this, but I'm sure we'll find a way, but you apply it so that you apply the initial recognition exception to have no effect in profit or loss.
Okay.
All right, okay. So with that clarification, sorry.
And then the second question was, would this amendment deal with the question that was just raised in the balance sheet, the presentation? Because I think some people believe that you can net.
I would think you could, because they're going to be, almost by definition, these deductions are coming from the same tax authority, aren't they? Because it's
So we wouldn't necessarily do anything special in a sense, but there's already offsetting requirements in IS-12. So we think they would just apply, and very often we'd expect that you would meet those.
John?
I agree with the recommendation. I think and I do agree that you have to attribute the payments first to the asset or liability. That's what IAS 12 requires, and if they're attributed to the asset, you don't have any temporary differences. If they're attributed to liability, you do, and I agree with the rationale here for why the initial recognition exception is not necessary. I also think it gives you better accounting going forward in terms of the effective tax rate and reflects more the economics of what's happening with the tax effects of the lease arrangements. Obviously, on something like decommissioning expenses, you may not meet the criteria because you may not get to recognise a DTA because it's at the end of the life. So it doesn't apply indiscriminately, which I think is correct, because you would not have potentially an asset in that situation. I am conscious of Bertrand's point about the cost. I mean, for thousands and thousands of leases, tracking that, but it's probably not much different than lots of other assets where you have to track tax effects. You just have to somehow, the systems will have to be developed to track the tax effects of all these various lease arrangements. But I do think it is good to move ahead with standard setting. I mean, there is acknowledged difference in the three views which were discussed previously at the committee do exist in practice, and I think it would be an improvement to financial reporting to progress with this amendment.
Okay, thanks. Bruce.
Thanks, Sue. I've got a couple of comments. To start off with, I mean, we've always applied the initial recognition exemption to these transactions, so for us, if there's going to be a change, it's quite a substantial one in terms of how we've done them. In terms of the approach that the paper takes, I support this, the narrow scope amendment. I don't support the approach and the interpretation. I think it doesn't get us to where we need to get to at all. In fact, I think we'll end up with 10 more questions if we published it than that. Just a couple of things I wanted to... I was just a bit concerned that the paper refers to the offsetting in paragraph... No, where was it? It was paragraph 59 of the paper. And I wasn't particularly comfortable about that, because I think we're kind of setting a principle at the moment, and this ties a bit in with where we were talking about where the initial exemption will still apply to a difference. And maybe it's just my understanding, so bear with me. But we're saying that we're going to look at the asset and the liability, and we're going to raise deferred tax as and when required in terms of where there is a temporary difference. I can live with that. If there's offsetting, well, if the amounts are the same and they offset the income statement, great. But that's just a function of balancing debits and credits. That's not a function of any principle we're setting. That's just the reality. Which means if on day one you've got a difference, and my concern about that is that we're going to get a difference in quite a few of these. I mean, if you think of leases and things, you're capitalizing different things here, you've got advance payments, you could end up with some differences that just happen to be there. If we're now saying that you'd still apply the initial recognition exemption to just that difference, are we not kind of setting a principle on what we want to change and then bypassing it yet again with the exemption? I mean, isn't the reality that if you've got a difference on day one, well, guys, that's the reality of the accounting. You know, are we not kind of taking away the initial recognition? I keep getting this wrong. The initial recognition exemption, we're kind of taking it away on a principles base, saying we don't want to have it there. We're happy for it to work, but in circumstances where it doesn't work, we're just going to throw the exemption at it again. And I just worry a little bit that there's not really consistency around what we're saying we're going to do on that. You know, is it a principle base that these two things need to raise deferred tax, or is it we don't like the initial recognition? And what is our justification for why we're doing that?
I would say that it is completely in line with the justification that is there for the initial recognition exception, you know, in the first place, is that, yes, ideally, in principle, we would recognise temporary differences. We recognise deferred tax assets and liabilities for these temporary differences. That's what IAS 12 sort of has as its core principle. But when IAS 12 was written, the board accepted that in the cases where you got an entry to profit or loss on initial recognition, when it was an equal exchange, that was information that wasn't useful and didn't give I'm not sure they would have expressed it in this way, but didn't give a faithful representation of the transaction. So the point about the initial recognition exception was to move away from the core principle of IAS 12 in circumstances where it was giving a result that wasn't useful. And all we're doing here is we're saying, well, actually, in these situations, although they fall within the scope of the words of the initial recognition exception, they don't actually fall within the scope of what it was set up to avoid. So it would be entirely within, consistent with the thinking that put it there in the first place, not to include these transactions within it to the extent that you don't get an impact on profit or loss. So it's moving from the principle in IAS 12, but in exactly the way that the initial recognition exception was originally set up.
But why not just leave the status quo then?
Because that is applying the initial recognition exception to transactions where it's not needed and is causing problems in practice.
But we're still applying it because there's a difference.
So maybe I'll clarify the difference point, and that I know in the paper there's a couple of paragraphs we talk about more complex situations. And, for example, if we think about leases, and I don't know if this was your point, Bob, I think it's, you know, we're going to need to explain this well in the words, but I think a focus for me and what we're focusing on here is transactions. So, for example, if we think about when you might get a different number, you know, so at lease commencement,
when do we think we might get a different number for the lease asset versus the lease liability? And the most obvious one is advanced lease payments. There might be a bit of initial direct cost. And if you work through the numbers on that, I think we would expect that this would capture that situation. And the reason is to try and explain it. So even though on lease commencement, you'd end up having a different number as your asset and liability because you've already paid something. That's why it's different. And if you've already paid something, that's clearly part of the cost of the asset, but you've already paid it, so it's not part of the liability. But what happens there, if you work through the mechanics, is assuming that all of those payments are deductible when you pay the cash, when you made the advance payment on credit cash and debited an asset, you would have set up deferred tax at that point because it would have immediately affected your tax. So because you already have a deferred tax asset or liability, I have to remember, set up, when you come along and do your almost your transaction, you know, entry at lease commencement, which means when you do that entry, you end up with a different amount of a deferred tax asset and deferred tax liability. However, that debit and credit that you do at lease commencement, you're debiting and crediting exactly the same amount of deferred tax. So I know without a whiteboard, that's not very understandable. but basically, if you work the mechanics, the way we're proposing this narrow scope amendment would capture situations where you've got advanced lease payments or, for example, initial direct costs paid in advance where they are deductible on a cash basis.
I'll be honest, I need to work through that a bit more in my mind. But I'm saying my only concern is that we're putting through a change where we're saying we're taking away the initial recognition exemption because we don't think that principle applies to these transactions. But if you've got a difference, it still applies.
Yeah.
And I'm just, to me, that's the part that I think...
Only to the extent it's not needed.
Yeah. But even if it's to the extent, I'm just saying we're applying something that we're taking away from the core. Anyhow, we'll work through those numbers.
Bonnie.
I would agree with where the staff has gotten to, that I think we need to make a change to IS-12. Perhaps a more radical suggestion is to get rid of the initial recognition exemption. And I'm going to say something even more radical. Because U.S. GAAP does not have an initial recognition exemption, and I don't think that's created problems in practice. I could be wrong. But so that... I heard the reaction, but I'll just put that out there.
Silence spoke a thousand.
Yeah, a big gasp. But I also have some concerns similar to Bertrand from a preparer's perspective. There's no way this could be done in time. And to deal with the IFRS 16 adoption, which is a significant challenge, and then to deal with a change in tax accounting, which could come at a different time, could also be a significant challenge. And with the number of leases that we have, it would be significantly difficult for us to manage the details across the number of jurisdictions that we have. So theoretically, yes, I think we need to do something. Practically speaking, it's going to be a big challenge because of the time, which I think would be part of the reason why I was suggesting elimination of the exemption, because that perhaps could be done a bit quicker than trying to finagle kind of how to make it specifically apply. But
I think that's quite a big ask.
I have a supporter. Okay.
Your ejection seat button is missing. Yes.
I will disappear into the floor in just a second here.
I mean, maybe just to ask Bonnie, and I think this is maybe what coming across, just to clarify that obviously applying IS-12 in lots of situations can be pretty complicated and a big ask. Do you think that this is them thinking about leases, obviously, you know, because of the sheer volume of leases that companies often have, that's what makes this particularly difficult? And would you say, you know, beyond what you typically experience in applying IS-12 in other situations?
there are a lot of leases that will be coming on balance sheet at once that creates a challenge to do everything at once. On perhaps an ongoing basis, it may not be as significant of a challenge. I don't know. I haven't kind of fully sussed that out. But because everything's coming on at once, it will be a challenge to get kind of everything right at the balance sheet date.
And obviously, we'll need to say in
perhaps
that
Bertrand and Carl have, you know, can weigh in as well because they, you know, prepares as well, perhaps different, you know, situations. But
I think we,
and Martin, sorry.
I think we understand that, and I think we'd have to be at a minimum very careful in terms of being accommodating in terms of the reasonable time period for an effective date and transition relief.
Because that
would be a second thing we'd need to look at.
Yeah, because I just wanted to add, obviously, the effective date of IFRS 16 is only 6 months away. And obviously, just to make it clear, anything we're talking about is standard setting. So it would first of all go out for comment, and we then have to appropriately consider the mandatory effective date on transition.
But I think my point also is that if we don't change something and you are in the situation where you're applying the deduction towards the lease liability, your effective tax rate is non-explainable, frankly. And while I don't know how much that applies across the board, I think generally speaking, most of the time the deductions are applicable to the asset side and the depreciation rather than the liability side, but I don't know the magnitude of what that could be. So, you know, even if you do consider the transition requirements, you're going to get a weird effective tax rate that could be significant, that may be extremely nonsensical to explain.
Tony.
Thinking about removing the initial recognition exception, I remember, I guess Anne probably remembers, the last time that was attempted.
Yeah.
Probably has very little ambition to try and do it again. But I thought this was a very good paper. I thought it reflected the discussion that we had previously. And I support continuing to explore this as a solution. I think it addresses the concern that we had previously that the standard does not tell you how to allocate the tax deductions. So anything that you end up doing is likely to be arbitrary, and if there is an arbitrary choice, then you're going to get people doing a choice or whatever, but you're going to get people doing different things. And I think if you end up in a situation where you do get, and they're not really permanent differences, they're actually temporary differences. It's just the deferred tax hasn't been recognised flowing through the tax rec. I think that is an unhelpful model. So I think that this proposal addresses that. It eliminates an exception, which is there for perfectly good reasons, but it actually eliminates an exception. I think I completely support going ahead with it. I think my two observations would be to think through how the model will apply when there is a difference. I agree if it's payments made before the lease commencement date, I understand how that works. I just wonder if there are other differences and whether it's just worth thinking through what else could cause the difference. And then secondly, just again explaining in a bit more detail than there was in here, how the model works if you don't pass the recognition threshold for a deferred tax asset and what the subsequent accounting for that would be. So would you be saying if you don't meet the recognition threshold on day one, the initial recognition exception applies, which means you wouldn't subsequently get to book the deferred tax asset, or are you thinking something? So just not prejudging the outcome, but just thinking through that a little bit further. But overall, I think it was a good paper. I support the staff proposal.
Andrew?
Similarly, I thought that, in principle, this is quite a nice, neat solution. And so, like Tony, I would be supportive of exploring this further. My reading of the paper, particularly if I look at paragraph 55, was that I thought that the staff were saying to take a component approach purely to the asset and liability arising from the lease, and everything else would be dealt with separately. So that would cover not just the advance payments, but attributable costs that you might capitalise into anything else. So it's really pulling down that component of the lease transaction where, from a tax perspective, it's a net off down to zero. I think it's quite a neat way, potentially, of dealing with it. I, too, remember the earlier ill-fated attempt with the initial recognition exemption, so perhaps not go there, but I'll keep going with this.
Thanks, Andrew. Martin?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, if he decides to go for an amendment today, we are not done, right? Because, I mean, it would take a long time to draft it, and then it will be commented, and I mean, I'm a little bit with Tony. There are issues which are still open, but there are many questions out. And with regard to first-time application, I guess we are probably more at 2021 than 2020 or so. I mean, if you consider how long it takes to have the amendment included and endorsed and so on, so that would be an appropriate timeline also for preparers to consider that. So I'm probably more in favor to go into the drafting of the amendment and then see how discussion will bring us to.
Okay. Thanks, Martin. Reinhardt?
So I agree with the staff analysis, and a lot of my comments are entirely consistent with what Tony said. I think neither alternative is a perfect solution. I think, as Anne said, I personally think the alternative of narrowing the initial recognition exemption is an elegant solution. So I would support that, and as consistent with the comments made by Tony and others, I think in developing that, the staff needs to think through some of the issues we just talked about. But overall, I definitely agree with going that route.
Okay, thank you. So along the way, there's been a few more suggestions for homework for the staff. but based on that discussion, could I get a show of hands on whether or not the committee agrees with the staff recommendation in paragraph 72, which is to go forward and develop a narrow scope amendment to IAS 12, and we'll have a look at the additional issues that have been raised.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
That's 12 and further. Thank you very much.
So, practical question asked by a group of preparers in France. So IFRS 16, and it's very similar to what Martin just said. So we're speaking about 2020, 2021 for these amendments. So what happens in 2019? So IFRS 16 will apply. We can easily think that if a company was practicing an exemption, then it will still practice the exemption until the amendment comes through. If they were not, because they were having finance lease liabilities or a provision for decommissioning liabilities on which they were already doing a full balance sheet approach, then they will keep on their full balance sheet approach. Why? What if a company wants to change its practice? If the direction is to go for a full balance sheet approach, I would see not a huge number of companies departing from this application for applying the exemption, but the other way around. This was a practical question, honestly. I would see no problem why they could not, but... I don't know if anyone around the table has a view on that.
I think the practical answer to the question is that because we've decided that We need to do narrow scope standard setting to address this specific fact pattern. In the interim, the reality is that people need to work with IAS-12 as it is,
yeah,
interpret it as it is, and if anybody's looking at a potential change in accounting policy, the normal requirements in IAS-8 apply. Because we haven't done anything in the interim.
I will figure out, but...
Okay. We've earned a break, so I propose we break now and reconvene at 2 o'clock.
Sounds good.